Welcome to the Word at First Pres. During Advent, we are doing a series called Christmas Tableaus. A tableau is an illustration, often with religious overtones. The idea of each sermon will be to take an object from the story of Jesus' birth and discuss how it informs our faith. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful Advent and a very Merry Christmas.
Now I'm going to read the lesson from Exodus, the 13th chapter. They set out from Succoth and camped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. The Lord went in front of them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them along the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light so that they might travel by day and by night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Our second scripture reading comes from Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." And when they had heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising until it stopped over the place where the child was. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
So, before I get going today, I want to give you all some news, which is really important, and it's a date, which is February 26. Do you know what that date is? It's not Judy's last day, although her last day will be like the 15th. February 26 is the first Sunday in Advent, or in Lent. Here we are in Advent, in Lent, and it's also the day that we will be back in the chapel for the first time. So, that's the day that we're aiming for right now, to be back in there, and that's like set. It's going to be in like all of our publications. It's going to be out there. We finished most of the work in there. We just had the AV stuff installed, but we got a lot of little things we have to do to get it ready because we want it to be perfect for you guys when you come back in, but it is going to be an amazing space when we get back in there. So I'm super excited about it, and I just wanted you all to know because you all have put up with this for a long time, and I just want to say thank you, and we're going to be back there, and it's going to be just fantastic. So that's the first thing. Second thing is we're doing a sermon series called Christmas Tableaus. Some of you have been here for this series. A tableau is an illustration, usually with religious overtones behind it. If you've ever seen a tableau in real life, it's when they take a famous painting or a picture and they recreate it, right? The people are recreating how the people in the portrait or the picture look, and then they have all these items in the background to make it a real live staged event. So my thought was, hey, we have all these scenes from the Advent stories and from Jesus' birth. Let's take those and we'll take an object out of that. And we can talk about how the stories, they hinge on those objects. And so we've been looking at objects each and every week. And we've been examining, what do they tell us about the story? How do they impact Jesus' life? How do they impact our faith? And we're actually asking for you all to send in your own Christmas illustrations, your own tableaus. And we're doing this by asking you to think about what is the most important item that represents Christmas to you. So it could be something like an ornament that was passed down from generation to generation. Maybe it's a stocking. Maybe it's a Christmas gift you were given. Maybe it's a Christmas movie. For me, it's this. And if you want to know what this means, you have to come on Christmas Eve because I'm going to talk about my own Christmas tableau there. That's right. It's a way to pull you in. So what we want you to do is we want you to think about yours, take a picture of it, send it to Katie Allen, and then with a little description, and then Katie Allen's going to put it out in the lobby out there on the corkboard, and we're going to be able to read what everybody's is so we can share our own Christmas tableaus with each other. So this is only until next Sunday. After next Sunday, we're not doing it anymore. So if you can think about it, take the photo, send it to her. We'll put it up for you. How many people were here last week? How many people love those sheep? They were the best. They were the best. And even though one peed during my sermon, it was okay. They were still wonderful animals. They were amazing. I paid them off. They didn't make a sound the entire time, which was kind of weird because when they were out there, they were making a lot of noise. And then they didn't make a peep when they came in. And they were super soft and super cute. Can we all agree on that? It's going to be very hard to beat it, but today we're going to be doing the star. That's what we're talking about today. Now, the story that we just read is an iconic story in Jesus' birth narrative. So what we find is we have these magi, better known as wise men, and they are searching for the Messiah. And what they see is this star that is rising into the sky, and they follow that star into the area of Galilee, and there they go to Herod. And by going to Herod, they say, hey, by chance, have you seen this new king who has been born? We would like to pay him tribute. And what does Herod say? He's like, oh, no, I have not met him yet. But if you find him, let me know where he is, because I would love to pay tribute as well. Herod, of course, being very paranoid about any threat to his throne, his idea is he's going to assassinate this young king. Now, if you know anything about the Bible, if you've read the Bible carefully, and Judy will tell you this, this story technically does not belong in Advent, because Jesus has already been born at that point. But I think it's fair game. And do you know why I think it's fair game? Because every nativity scene has the wise men there when he's born, like literally in the barn when he's there, when he's born. So, and we have it in our pageant too. Christmas Eve pageant, you're going to have wise men there. It happens after, but they're still here. So it's fair game, in my opinion. And next week, we're going to even continue on with this, where we're going to talk about the gifts. Next week, we deal with the gifts that are given to Jesus' family by these wise men. But today we're going to deal a little bit with the history of the wise men. Who were they? Where did they come from? What are these men all about? Because as you peel back these layers, there's some really interesting facets of this story that you may not know about. The first thing you need to know, though, is that Matthew doesn't tell us much about it. When we read the story, he just tells us that there are some wise men who come from the east. That's it. We don't know where exactly they're from. We don't know who they are. But there is a little bit of an indication in the Greek. If you look at the Greek, the word that he uses is magos. And magos refers to astrologers. So these are people who study the stars. But if you dig a little deeper into the etymology of this word, you actually find that it actually has Persian origins. So it really is derived from a Persian word, magus, which refers to the priestly caste of a religion known as Zoroastrianism. And if you're sitting there saying, that sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook, well, Zoroastrianism plays a really important role. And you probably remember, back in 2017, I preached a sermon in Advent about Zoroastrianism. And I know you remember that as clear as the day your first child was born. So just bring yourself back to that moment. I'm sure you're going to be able to put yourself there. But for those of you who may not have been here for that, I'll give you a little update on what I talked about, which is this idea that this religion, Zoroastrianism, that is actually where the concept of the Messiah comes from. So literally, the Jewish people did not have that concept themselves. They borrowed it from Zoroastrianism. So why does that matter? It matters because these aren't just any wise men from the East. These are priests from the Zoroastrian religion, which means they would have been familiar with all of the prophecies surrounding the Messiah. Do you see what I'm saying? So just that little word right there tells us about who they are and that they would have known about this and why they would have known about it. But why were they? What were they doing? Well, of course, they were these astrologers. And because they were astrologers, they would study the stars. And they had these particular wise men, these magi, they had gained an international reputation for the ability to interpret the stars, which at the time was seen almost as a science to them. kings would call on astrologers when they had to make really important decisions because they would look at the stars and they believed that if you studied them the right way, the movement of the stars in the sky and all of that, that it could help you understand events that were going to be happening on Earth. This can be hard for us to appreciate in our day and time today because when we look up at the sky, particularly in Chicago, what do you see? Not much, right? You know, because there's a lot of light pollution. But back in those days, because there was very little light pollution, if it was a clear night, you could see the entire Milky Way with your eyes, literally with your naked eye. You could see it in the night sky. Now, what's important to understand is that these, when they looked up, they didn't realize that all those stars they were seeing were suns like our sun, just further away. They didn't understand that. What they thought was, these are gods and angels that are walking around in the sky. That's why when they looked up, they thought it was literally heaven. So they're looking up at this and they believe that if you could track the movement of all of the stars, the gods, and the planets, that that would tell you what's happening here on Earth. It would give you insight into what was happening, which is why they're following the star, because if the star is moving, this is going to, they believe, lead them to a big event. Now, we actually do know that around the time that Jesus was born, there was a major astrological event, a star, so to speak. So this star was actually Halley's Comet. If you do the math backwards, what you know or what you can find out is that Halley's Comet, it's on a 76-year orbit. It came around 11 BC. Now, that's around the time period that Jesus was born, 11 BC. So just imagine you're one of these astrologers. This would have been a big event because you know anything about a comet. They didn't realize it was a comet, but if you know a comet, it moves across the sky, and just imagine you're one of these astrologers. That's a big deal because you can literally follow it in the sky. People all over the Middle East would have been looking at this star, trying to follow it and figure out where it's going. Now, today, though, we're in a little bit of a different situation than we were back then because yes, these guys were following the star. They wanted to know where it was going to lead them. But today, do you look at astrological phenomena to determine what's going to happen in your life, to determine the events that are going to happen? How many people in here read your horoscope still? Yeah, absolutely, right? Yeah, horoscopes are great, aren't they? Funny enough, my wife and I, when we were living out in LA, a friend of hers wrote horoscopes for the newspaper. And so I asked her, I was like, how do you do it? How do you write the horoscope? Do you study the stars? She's like, no, I just make it up. So just so you know, if it does happen to coincide with anything that's going on in your life, it is totally made up. But even though today we don't associate astrological phenomena in the same way, we still need guiding lights in our lives. Would you agree? Absolutely. And I believe that that's what this story is really about. It's this idea that we have these guiding stars that light our paths and help us to navigate the unknowns in our lives. And we don't just see this in this story. It was in the story that you heard Judy read from Exodus. So in that story, what happens? God appears as a pillar of cloud during the day and fire at night to lead the Israelites through the wilderness. And so there's this idea from the beginning of the Bible all the way to the New Testament that if you have the right perspective on the world, that you can see how God is guiding your path. The problem is that if you don't have the right perspective, you're not going to be able to see these paths that are right in front of your eyes. So the question that I want to answer for us this morning is how do you have the right perspective to see those paths, those stars that are literally right in front of your eyes? So to prime this for you, I want to pose a question, which is, what are the stars that you've encountered in your life? What are the people, the conversations, maybe even the realizations that you've had that have come at exactly the right place and exactly the right time to help you find your way? And to illustrate this for you, I want to tell you a story this morning that I believe really encapsulates this idea of these guiding stars in our lives. And the story I'm going to tell you is about a man who follows his star And he ends up becoming a savior to millions of people. So the story begins in July of 1918. A young boy, his name is Rolala, he is born into this small little village of Mezzo. And in this village, in his little colloquial language, Rolala, it literally means troublemaker. And this is a moniker that would follow him for the rest of his life. His father was a chief of his village, and he was an advisor to the monarch in his area. And the way he spent most of his days, he was out in the fields, like with the sheep, and he would spend his day kind of herding them, and he would be with all the little older village boys, and he would play with them. But his mother and father, even though they were not educated and they were illiterate, they wanted their son to have the benefit of an education. And his mother was Christian, a very devout Christian, and so she wanted him to go to a Christian school. And so she found a Methodist school in the area that would accept him at the age of 7. So he goes to this school, and one of his teachers, who he was working with, did not like his tribal name of Rolala. So she gives him a new name, and that new name is Nelson, and he becomes known as Nelson Rolala Mandela. Now, Nelson Mandela, he goes to this school until about the age of 12. And it's at that time that his mother decides that she wants him to be raised in the palace of Chief Delinyebu. So she moves him to the palace, and this changes his life completely because now he's being raised next to the chief's son. And he has access to the best private schools for black students in South Africa. This picture right here is one that was taken in 1937 when he's in the midst of those elite black institutions. And he does so well that he decides that he wants to go study law at Witwatersrand in 1943. And he goes to this school, and he finds something very interesting. He's the only black student in this institution. But he's there with Europeans, he's there with Jews, he's there with Indians. And a lot of these people were connected with the Communist Party. And they would all come together for these Communist Party functions. And he really loved it because in this moment when he was together, everybody mixed as equals. Didn't matter whether you were black, European, Indian, Jewish, everybody talked together as equals. And this was a very important moment for him because it became a model for what he believed society should look like. One that's free of racial and class-based distinctions. So he's in law school, and then in 1948, something huge happens in South Africa. The Nationalist Party comes to power. These are the members of the Nationalist government, and they ran on the platform that they were going to institute policies of segregation. They were going to codify them into law, which became known as apartheid. And this changed the game for South Africa in a huge way, because now it was illegal for races to mix with each other. And this is what propelled Nelson Mandela to start to get into politics. He leaves his studies of law, and he starts working his way up through what is known as the ANP, the African National Party. And he does this for about a decade or so, but he becomes very disillusioned with politics. Because the problem is that he sees that the Nationalist Party has a stranglehold on the politics of South Africa. That with apartheid in place, nothing is going to change because there's nothing that the African National Party can really do about this. And he becomes more and more disillusioned to the point where he decides that he needs to go in a different direction. And so he creates a side organization known as the Spear of the Nation. This is known as the MK for short, and it was the militant wing of the African National Party. And the idea was that they were going to base it off of what Fidel Castro did over in Cuba during the Cuban Revolution. He was going to engage in acts of sabotage to basically bring the government to its knees so that then they would have the ability to negotiate around apartheid. So what they were going to do was they were going to bomb military installations, they were going to bomb power plants, they were going to bomb telephone lines, transit depots, anything with the infrastructure of the South African government. Because the idea was if they do it at night, they'll have low civilian casualties, hopefully none, and it would allow for them to be able to negotiate afterwards to result in racial reconciliation. So they announced their existence on December 16th, 1961, with 57 bombings on the same day all over South Africa at various points. And they did it again on New Year's Day. So you can imagine the police were looking for them very heavily. They wanted to find them. They wanted to bring them to justice. And with the help of the American CIA, they actually did find Nelson Mandela. They captured him, arrested him on August 5th, 1962, less than 8 months after he founded Spear of the Nation. He was, of course, put on trial. He was convicted of treason and terrorism, and he was sentenced to life in prison. And he was sent to Robben Island. This is Robben Island. It's an island off the coast of South Africa. It was a very dire existence there on Robben Island. He was placed in a 7-by-8-foot cell. He slept on the floor of that cell, and he was given a bucket for a toilet. Because he was the lowest class of prisoner, known as Class D, because he had been convicted of terrorism and treason, he was allowed one visitor every 6 months and one letter every 6 months, and that letter was highly censored. He also had to engage in hard labor. And that hard labor was that every day, for 8 hours a day, he would be sent out to a lime quarry that was on the island. And there on that lime quarry, he would have to break limestone rock 8 hours a day, and the glare from the sun off of that limestone permanently damaged his eyes. When Nelson Mandela arrived on Robben Island, he was a very, very angry man, understandably so. He had tried to work to undo an unjust system of apartheid, and now he was in prison for the rest of his life, and he wasn't ever going to get out. And so when he came in, he was a man who was always willing to fight. He was always willing to go against the guards. And the guards, their entire job there, from their perspective, was to break your spirit. They were going to break you, and they were going to make you follow the rules. And so for the first couple of years, when Mandela was prone to these violent outbursts, it was a really, really hard time for him. He really struggled. But the one thing that he could do while he was there was he could read books. And one of the books that he eventually came across in his time was written by Mahatma Gandhi. And he became very enamored with Gandhi because Gandhi was dealing with a very similar situation to what he was dealing with. If you remember, the British had also colonized India. And Gandhi had worked very hard while he was in India to be able to free them of colonial rule and British occupation, which he was able to do. And so he started reading all these books by Gandhi, India of My Dreams, Nonviolent Resistance. And he felt a spiritual connection to Gandhi. In many ways, and I think this is very true to say this, Gandhi was, to Nelson Mandela, literally a shining star, a guiding light to him. And as he read more and more about him, he decided he wanted to follow in his footsteps. And so what would happen is, every day he would read a little bit of Gandhi's work. And then he would go out into the limestone quarry. And day after day, month after month, year after year, he would meditate on those words in the books from Gandhi while he was breaking the stone. And what ended up happening was something remarkable, that slowly, month after month, year after year, his heart began to soften to the point where he became this very, very calm, serene individual. In fact, he was so inflammable that the guards couldn't do anything to actually cause him to react anymore. He was impenetrable to outside influences. And on top of all of that, he also became somebody who the guards came to love. He became this very kind, gentle individual, to the point where he actually could melt the hearts of even the most hardened guards who were working there on Robben Island. And so this amazing thing happened, is that Gandhi became to him this star that guided his way through some of the darkest moments of his life. I mean, just imagine it for a moment. You are in one of the worst places on earth. You're stuck inside of this prison, ostensibly for the rest of your life. And then you find this star in the right place. And what he realized was that as he would go out and encounter the barren landscape of that limestone quarry, that it was no different from the barren landscape of his soul. And in that moment, he found God. I mean, literally, Gandhi helped Nelson Mandela find God in this moment. And he realized as he was breaking this stone day after day, that there was really no difference between him and the stone, that they were one and the same. And so he stopped seeing the stone that he was breaking as a punishment, but as an extension of himself. And he really believed in what Gandhi talked about, which is that we are all one. And so as a result of this, he became a transformed man. He went from a man who was violent and angry and willing to kill to a man who was kind and peaceful. And when he was released 18 years later, and he was brought back in, he was no longer the man we knew. He became the man who we all know and love. And as a result, he became a savior. He literally saved the people of South Africa, millions of people. He transformed that country from a place of intense racism to a place of reconciliation. Now, this is the reason why I love this story. I love this story because it really does mirror what we see in the story that we read this morning. Because what you see is the same idea, that God sends us these guiding stars in the darkest moments of our lives, that when it can't get any darker, God will be there for us. And in Nelson Mandela's instance, which I just think is so amazing, think about being in there. Would you ever find light in a place like that? Do you think you would ever see light? Knowing that you're going to be in prison for the rest of your life, would you be able to see that? I don't know if I could. But he saw it. There was a moment where he saw the star that was in front of him, and the star, it made a difference. And it transformed the world. Now, I pose the question to you. Who have been the guiding stars in your life? Who have been the people who have been there at just the right place, just the right time, to transform your life and change where you have gone? I think we all have it. Can you think of somebody? Maybe it's a teacher. Maybe it's a mentor. Maybe it was a friend. Maybe a colleague. Maybe a pastor. Maybe a sibling. Maybe a parent. Maybe it was a book that you read. Maybe it wasn't even the person who was there with you. Maybe it was an idea or a conversation. But all of you have something in your mind, don't you? Okay. Here's what I want you to do today. If that person is still alive, and I'm not sure for all of you they will be, but if that person is still alive or you have access to that person, I want you to reach out to them today if you have access. Call them today and just say, hey, I was thinking about you and I want to thank you for what you did for me. Or write them a letter, because they may not realize how that was God sending you a star in the middle of that moment in your life. They may not even see it that way, but the fact is that that's what it was to you. And they may not even know that. A lot of people who operate that way, they don't even know what they did. So take some time today and reach out to them, because I think that's really important. The second thing I want you to do is I want you to think about how you can be that guiding star to other people in your life. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, he didn't just recede into the background. He didn't just go away. No, he became somebody who was going to be that star over Bethlehem to everyone else. Because Gandhi had been that to him, then he was going to do that for others. And that's what God asks of you. And I know some of you are sitting there thinking, Alex, I barely have my life together enough to get through what I'm doing. How could I possibly be a star to somebody else? You never know what you have to do. I'm not saying you got to transform a nation. I'm saying you got to be the right person in the right place at the right time. And sometimes that's just a conversation. Sometimes it's just a look of thanks. Sometimes it's giving somebody resources when they need it and they don't have it. You never know how you can be that star to other people. And so my hope and my prayer for you today is that as much as people have been there for you, that you could be there for others, because I believe God calls all of us to be that guiding light to those around us. We simply have to have the eyes to be able to see it. Not just those who are there for us, but how we can be there for others. And I think that if we do that together, we truly can change this world for the better. Amen.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to learn more about First Presbyterian Church of Arlington Heights, please visit www.firstpresah.org for more information on service times, directions, and to learn more about the First Pres family of faith.